This is Clusterfucked. Here's your host, Roger King.
Well, it's Clusterfucked time again. Welcome to another episode. I'm Roger King. My guest today is becoming a big part of the new wave of political data analysts who have gone mainstream, who analyze the polls and what the numbers are telling us, and then use that data to forecast election results. I guess Nate Silver is probably the most famous of these types from 538.com. But I think our guest today is giving him a run for his money. She has gotten a lot of well-deserved attention over the last year or so because her midterm elections forecast in 2018 was bang on, almost to the seat. She predicted the Democratic blue wave in which they flipped 40-plus seats, and she did so way ahead of any other analyst. And now she's out with her 2020 overview, which was published in the New York Times, in which her conclusion is basically that Donald Trump will likely lose his reelection bid. You may have seen her on MSNBC recently, where she was affectionately named America's second favorite Rachel. But because she's coming on this podcast and we haven't had Rachel Maddow, she's our favorite Rachel. She's assistant director for the Wasson Center for Public Policy at Christopher Newport University. Rachel Bitticoffer, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Clusterfucked.
Well, I got to say, that might be my favorite introduction ever of me. So you already have won me over.
All right. It can only go downhill from here.
That's true.
So before we dive into your analysis of the 2020 election and, you know, other things that you're seeing in the data and the research, I just thought I wanted to just recap 2016, as painful as that might be for some. I have a little theory about why Trump won. So I thought I'd throw it at you here and then get you to respond and probably segue into some things you're finding about partisanship and all the rest. So here goes. I think most analysts would agree that Trump won by a fluke. It was a perfect storm of events, and much of that, which has been covered, you know, quite frequently. You know, the Russian interference and FBI Director James Comey's letter announcing that Hillary Clinton was under investigation again 10 days before the election, which of course pushed a bunch of undecided voters probably into Trump's camp, holding their noses. And of course, he had two third-party candidates who were drawing some significant support in key states, and all of that came together, and he managed to squeak out a victory. Winning Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin by a grand total of about 80,000 votes, if you add up all three of the margins. But I think the simple explanation for what happened was basically a bunch of liberals stayed home, particularly in those three states I just mentioned. And I think they stayed home because there was no sign that Trump was going to win Michigan, Wisconsin, or Pennsylvania. The polls didn't show it. So I think he had a combination of maybe some lazy liberals who stayed on the couch and some who thought it was safe to vote third party. Maybe they weren't that crazy about Clinton, but they thought, you know, they didn't take it seriously that Trump was going to win. I saw a quote from a woman at one of Hillary Clinton's book signings. She said, "I'm sorry I didn't vote. I didn't think you needed me." So that sums it up for me. Maybe you can tell me where I'm right, where I'm wrong, and your overview of what happened.
I mean, that's a pretty good diagnostic there. You know, if you had read my book on the 2016 election, you'll find a lot of those elements appear in it. I do spend quite a bit of time talking about the defection. I mean, it's not just a little bit of third-party protest balloting defection. What we saw in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, really all across the country, were 5 to 6 times more protest balloting than we would normally see. And a lot of that, as you said, was driven by a sense of, you know, this is in the bag. I might as well go and vote my conscience or my heart because I don't really like this lady that, you know, right. I've been told my whole life sucks, you know. and then of course, the turnout. It's the turnout differential that, you know, that Obama thing just didn't manifest. And so that was a massive factor. And, you know, when you look at the difference between Obama's victories in 2012 and 2008 and what happened to Hillary Clinton in 2016, you're looking at those turnout differentials of those key Democratic constituencies, and you just can't argue that it's not, it didn't have a devastating impact on her failure to flip over those states. So.
Right. And I mean, you look at, you know, Jill Stein got 50,000 votes, I think, in both Wisconsin and Michigan or something like that. And I have to believe that, well, in Michigan, for example, my home state, the margin I think Trump won by was about 10,000. So I have to believe that if, you know, a percentage of those 50,000 actually thought Hillary could possibly lose, they might not have voted for Stein. But, you know, we'll never know.
Yeah. I mean, I actually asked some of the most strident Sanders supporters for my book about that. And of course, it's not possible really to capture the emotions, you know, so I think they underestimated how much that might have impacted them. But even, you know, superficially, a lot of them admitted, yeah, you know, that would have definitely impacted how I, you know, my choice to go and vote for Jill Stein. And of course, when I wrote the book, this is prior to our knowledge of the targeted propaganda coming from the Russians towards Black voters to get them to not show up to vote, and towards these progressives to get them to protest ballots. So we only found out about that, you know, after I wrote the book.
Of course. Now, let me segue into 2018 for a second. You've been on the record lately as going a little bit against what I think is some of the conventional wisdom about what happened, because you're hearing from a lot of pundits and some analysts that Democrats ran these moderate candidates in some of these swing slash formerly Republican districts. The moderate candidates stayed away from talking about Trump too much, and they concentrated on health care and maybe a couple of other sort of kitchen table issues. And that's why they won. Your argument, if I understand it, is actually that it was just all people repelled by Trump, essentially, and Democrats could have done even better in the midterms if they had played more to the base and made it about Trump and that sort of thing. Do they have the analysis right?
I mean, you do, and I want to really stress, so like there's everybody saying that first diagnosis, which is the old school paradigm, and then there's me, right? and I'm not just saying it. I mean, number one, my entire forecast would not have functioned if that was not the case, if it wasn't turnout, surge and decline turnout, because that was what my forecasting model was, you know, based on, was this idea that it would be the entrance of voters, you know, riled up from Trump, even if they aren't likely to tell you I'm riled up by Trump. That's what was making turnout increase by 19 points over a regular midterm. So my model would have failed spectacularly, because the way that it was designed was built on a turnout surge and decline hypothesis. But number two, you know, I've done post-election autopsies on the voter files, and I've expanded that since I became nerd famous, because now I have access to more data. And I only had two states, California and Virginia, to start. But all of the districts that I've analyzed thus far show, you know, right there in the voter file, you can literally see, you know, it was the entrance of Democrats and different independents, not the ones that had been casting ballots for Republicans in the past, that flipped these districts, not moderate Republicans, not even the same independents that had been voting before for Republican candidates.
Yeah, liberals got off the couch, in other words.
Yeah, I mean, there has been for a long time this demographics are destiny. You know, the truth of the matter is that those authors weren't wrong with the hypothesis. The problem is that number one, there are the factors that make people likely to vote. The two things that are most important in that regard are family socialization. So did your parents vote? And the second thing is education, college education. So college education can make up for that family, you know, tradition, and the Democratic coalition being younger and more diverse, particularly the Latino end of the coalition, is there's more Democrats, but they are less likely to have those factors. And so we've been seeing for a long time an untapped potential, and Donald Trump, the election of that, the getting caught with your pants down-ness of the 2016 election has really changed, you know, that, and we've seen that play out in election and after election.
Nerd famous, is that an official phrase?
I think so.
I love it. You mentioned college-educated voters, which I wanted to touch on because that's one of the keys to your analysis. You know, I've said before, I think on this podcast, how I think a lot of liberals are surprised that at least, you know, in past years, Republicans tended to win college education voters, because we think of, you know, Harvard and Stanford and some of these, you know, places where liberals are. Well, maybe not Harvard so much, but you know what I mean. But of course, someone who goes to Jerry Falwell University is also a college educated voter. But anyway, the point being, now we're seeing a shift towards the Democrats on that, and that's key to your analysis, correct? Can you take us through what's happened with these college educated voters during the Trump era?
Yes, and I'm really glad that you're mentioning that as well. I mean, here we are sitting in 2019 after the 2018 election, and so everybody knows college-educated voters are realigning to the Democratic Party. But, you know, after the 2016 election, the reason my model was innovative was that I expected this massive shock to a slow-moving realignment. I want to be clear. It's not like I was the first person to ever notice that there was a realigning going on. But white college-educated voters had been voting for GOP candidates for a long time. And in 2016, you know, white college-educated women for the first time actually voted majority for Hillary Clinton. We don't we forget that because people get angry and talk about white women and how they broke for Trump, and they did. But when you separate non-college-educated and white college-educated women, white college-educated women for the first time ever voted for the Democrat. It was a very modest majority, but it was a majority. And what I anticipated was, okay, we've had this alignment, and this is a product, by the way, of the Republican Party's civil war, where the populist nativist part of the party staged a revolution starting in 2009, 2010, and, you know, basically pushed smart people away, especially millennials, because we're not talking about so much talking about college-educated voters changing their party affiliation, although there are some of them, and those voters are moving largely from Republican to independent. But we are talking about the second generation, right? So the millennial women, their mothers are Republican. They are voting Democrat, right? Mm-hmm. Anyway, I knew that it was going to be like kerosene on that realignment. And so in my predictive model, I predicted two things would matter: the partisan composition of the district or the state as a measure of polarization, and college education. How much college-educated population is in there,
right?
For this backlash effect to Trump. And, you know, now it's a staple that everybody's looking at and understands is a predictive element for Democrats, but it was never before a good vote indicator for Democrats. You're right.
Well, and which is why when people are talking about which states are going to be competitive in 2020, and we'll get to your overview analysis of 2020 in a second, but it's why I think your advice is to look at, if you're looking at, you know, people talk so much, of course, about Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, which we've mentioned off the top because Trump squeaked out his victories in those states. And so people are going, well, if the Democrats can flip those, then they win the election and you don't have to worry about anything else. But I think what you're advising is to look at some other states where the college-educated numbers are higher, which happen to be some red states, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's not exactly necessarily that the college education rates are higher, but they're comparable. And there's these giant surge potential populations that have not been tapped into. So when we think about what Beto O'Rourke did down in Texas, it was innovative. It was definitely an untraditional approach. But, you know, as I was unveiling this new paradigm of understanding elections and how to win them in the polarized era, I got very lucky because two candidates emerged, you know, that were basically running prototypes of my theory. One was running a pure version, and that was Stacey Abrams in Georgia, and the other was running a hybrid. And, you know, but in the case of Beto O'Rourke, you know, there still wasn't anywhere near the type of monetary and infrastructure investment into surge Latino turnout that you would need in Texas to make Texas blue. Texas has the demographics it needs today in 2019 to flip over. Mm-hmm. If there was basically a nuclear bomb level investment for the DNC in Latino turnout.
Right.
But right now, the way that Democrats think about winning Texas, right, they're going to nominate possibly, most likely right now anyway, MJ Hager. She didn't even flip the House district that she ran in a pretty favorable cycle. She's going to run the North Carolina 9 strategy, which is to focus on independence.
You're talking about the Senate race, we should clarify, correct?
Yeah, well, yes, for the Texas Senate race coming up, right?
Yeah, against John Cornyn.
Yeah, and if you want to win in Texas today, then tomorrow, then the path to victory is millennial Latinos. You have to get not just a little bit improvement on turnout there. You have to get massive improvement.
Right. And this segues nicely into the big debate in Democratic circles, which is, whether you go for the base and nominate someone who's going to fire people up, which is, I think, what you're advocating, versus trying to peel off some of those dissatisfied Trump voters or some of those moderates and that kind of thing. And that is the debate that plays out. Now, are you suggesting that there really aren't that many crossover voters at this point because partisanship is like everyone's really, I'm a Democrat, I'm a Republican, and there isn't that kind of crossover that there used to be because as you said, in the midterms, your research tells you that there weren't that many Republicans who crossed over and voted for Democrats. These were just people who already leaned Democrat but finally got off the couch. So are you saying there isn't much crossover potential the way there used to be?
Yeah, let me hit you with a few data bombs here.
Bombs. I wish we had like some kind of music or something. But
yeah, and let me explain what I'm talking about. I mean, number one, when we're talking about the two divergent strategies, like a Warren versus a Biden nomination, and my argument, right? I'm not saying you win the election by turning out base voting Democrats, okay? Mm-hmm. But I'm talking about turning out people who will cast ballots for Democrats, because keep in mind we have an electorate that generally participates at 55%, right? You change that to 62%, Democrats are going to win the White House. They're just bar none. Right? There's no way Republicans can win a high turnout election.
Right. Essentially, when people come out to vote, we've seen Democrats win Obama's elections.
Exactly,
in the midterms.
Right. Yeah. Right. So when I talk about, a lot of people like to say, oh, she's talking about turning out base Democratic voters. No, I'm talking about the Democratic coalition, which includes women, it includes millennials, it includes Latinos, it includes progressives, it includes, all kinds of different people. And then there's this huge segment of independents or people who are not Democrats who will cast ballots for Democrats that are also mobilized. So I was alluding to that voter file analysis that I did. When we look at a district like here in Virginia, we had three districts flip over to Democrats. All three were held by Republicans. Only one was a Clinton district, i.e. Clinton carried it in the 2016 election. The other two were carried by Trump. Okay.
Okay.
The conventional wisdom is that there was a segment of disaffected Republicans that joined with Democrats in 2018 to help elect these Democrats. Okay.
Right.
The data does not tell us that story. The voter file data doesn't tell it. The exit poll data doesn't tell it. In the polarized era, somewhere about 10% of voters in exit polling data will say, hey, I'm voting for the other party's candidate. There's very little deviation from those numbers. We'll see higher numbers in West Virginia with Democrats or Republicans voting for a Democrat, Manchin.
Right.
You'll see higher numbers in Pennsylvania or Massachusetts and Maryland with Democrats voting for Republicans, right?
Right. That's exactly, I was going to bring that up because of the governors in Massachusetts and Maryland are Republican and very popular.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a couple of exceptions, but by and large, the modal amount is about 10%, and it might go down from there. Very rarely does it go above 10%. It's notable if it goes up even 2 points above that. So in Arizona, Sinema managed to get 12% of the Republican vote. She is the one and only person in the data you can find evidence of additional crossover voting. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Then when we get down into the voter files to explain how did these districts flip, these 40 House seats, and especially the 20 that are like surplus districts that I was talking about flipping, where Nate Silver and Dave Wasserman and the other analysts were not yet on their radar in July when I unveiled my forecast. When we look at those districts, the way that they flipped is, in 2014, in the other midterms, they were getting, maybe 30% turnout. In 2018, the turnout was 60%. And the composition of that turnout changed dramatically. It was more Democrat, significantly more, because it was more African-American. It was more Latino. It was younger, more 20 voters under 30, more voters under 24, more women, right? So those people are different people. They're not the same people changing their mind. They're different people casting their ballots. And some of them were Democrats. Some of them were independents. There's absolutely no evidence that there were significant amounts of Republicans with buyer's remorse. And in fact, what the data does show is that Republicans were pretty damn happy with Donald Trump in 2018, because even without a stimulus, even without being in the opposition party, even without being, you know, having their sensibilities offended day after day by being out of power like the Democrats were, Republican turnout was really strong in 2018. And it could not have gone to the Democrats. The vote margins that these candidates won by, 54%, 53%, 52%, they won off the surge turnout of the independents and the Democrats, but they could not have carried these Republican votes and still had those modest margins.
Well, that was the other thing I should mention about, you know, your research and what you say consistently is that, because I think there are some in Trump Nation who try to argue that turnout wasn't that great in 2018 because Trump wasn't on the ballot. But as you just said, actually, no, they turned out.
Oh, they did.
Yeah.
They did. I mean, proportionately, what happened with Democratic turnout was amazing, right? I mean, but it was really shitty to begin with, so it had a lot of room to improve.
Right.
So it goes up, you know, 300% or whatever, right? Proportionally, the Republican turnout doesn't improve at rates of 200 to 300%, but it goes up. It went up over 2014. It didn't go down.
Right.
And I'll tell you something else to add more evidence to this pile. Number one, in every district so far that I've analyzed, and I'm about halfway done now through all of the new data that I've received, Republicans out turnout proportionally for their percent of registered voters in every district. They out turnout Democrats still.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In a wave year that should have benefited the Democrats, Republicans still had higher turnout. And in districts where Democrats ran true blue dogs, so, you know, had variation of Democrats running as liberal Democrats, as regular Democrats, and then you had like the blue dog Democrats.
Right.
In those blue dog Democrats, the Republican turnout was just as high as it was in all the other districts. Okay.
Yeah.
So there was no benefit to being so like unobtrusive.
Mm-hmm.
And the Democratic turnout was about 10 points lower.
These are in districts that Democrats still ended up winning, or
they still won it, but
right.
They you know, if they did that say in 2022 under a Democratic president, they'd be in significant trouble.
Right. Gotcha. Because of course then we'd have the reverse effect happening where Republicans are out of power and they're all fired up like we saw in the midterms during Obama.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. Republican turnout doesn't really vary. It's the Democratic turnout that's actually like surging and decline. It's really surge and collapse. That's what's happening. Yeah.
That's basically the lead of our whole conversation is like when Democrats show up, they win.
And you're not wrong. I mean, and it's not just Democrats too. Democrats and independents that cast their ballots for Democrats. So it's both.
And maybe we should just do a quick chat about independents, because I think some people get that sort of confused. The nature of independents is, and you tell me if I'm wrong in anything I say here, of course, but the nature of independent voters is changing. There are people who say were Republicans and they're now embarrassed by Trump. So when a pollster calls, they declare themselves independent. These things switch. I mean, for example, and you hear a lot, oh, it's the key to winning elections is winning independents. And, you know, Mitt Romney won independents in 2012, but he lost the election. So, you know, give us a little thumbnail overview of independents and where they're at now.
Yeah, you're the first person actually other than myself that knew that Romney carried the vote of independents but lost in 2012. And the reason he did is because of turnout.
Back to your thesis. So,
yeah. Right? So that's, you know, maybe more evidence there that it's turnout, right? So, so independents, I mean, you know, the media talks about it like this. There's this giant group of independents and there are these, you know, rational, you know, reasonable people that aren't cursed like the rest of America with partisanship, and they're therefore they are, you know, capable of rational thought. But the truth is that most of them are closet partisans. They say that they're independent because it's more socially desirable to say that than to be aligned with one of these two, I mean, ridiculously embarrassing parties. And yes, the Republican Party is more ridiculously embarrassing in the modern era than the Democratic Party is, especially with Trump at the helm. And so we see more independents are lean Republican than lean Democrat. And that's not an accident. It's a product of the brand problem that the Republican Party has right now.
Right.
And when we look at the behavior of those independents, you know, political science research has looked at how do these guys behave in their vote choice and their issue preferences. They are pretty much closet partisans. I mean, there's a little bit of more moderation. They're not 100%, it's not 100% correlation, but they do tend to vote Republican if they're lean R and tend to vote Democrat if they're lean D. And so when we siphon out those guys, what we're talking about is really somewhere between 10 and 15% of the electorate who are what we call, or I call, pure independents. And these guys are pure independents, not because they, some of them are like my mother-in-law, who is like, you know, truly an independent, and she is well-read and she researches everything, and, you know, but she's not typical at all. Most of these guys are, they're independent purely because they truly don't have strong emotions about politics. They aren't particularly interested in politics, so their turnout in off-year elections or off-year elections are lower. They aren't passionate about issues. So some of them are there because of appreciation for nuance. I mean, I like to say I'm a nuanced independent, right? but most of them are independent for lack of interest and lack of knowledge.
Right. And, you know, a good pollster, of course, will tease out what you said earlier about, you know, leaning. Do you lean Republican? Do you lean Democrat? And that's when you see that it really only comes down to that 10 or 15%. And
I would like to just shamelessly plug, too. We did a national survey at the Wasson Center last spring that's online on our website. We have so much great data there that people should go check out along with my forecast stuff. But it's called the Wasson Center National Survey.
Give us that URL if you can.
They'll just have to Google it. Just Google. Go up Wasson Center and you'll find the website. But the national survey there is, it has a breakdown of exactly what we're just talking about, how, number one, the ideological distribution of both parties, and also this idea of independence and leaners and all of that. They can literally see what we're talking about.
Right. And I mean, I was just about to say, I sort of laugh. I'm in, you know, some of these Facebook groups with a bunch of other liberals, and there will be a bunch of people in there who claim that they're independent. And I always challenge them, really? Do you ever vote Republican? Come on, you're in a liberal group. But they love to just have this, you know, vision of themselves of just weighing each candidate equally. And I'm not partisan. But let's finish up with 2020. You quite famously, part of your nerd famous evolution, you had an op-ed published in the New York Times, I think at the beginning of the year, if I'm not mistaken, like January, where you basically said, unless there's something unforeseen, Trump's going to lose. Can you explain the thesis behind that? I know we've touched on a lot of things here, but just as an overview to sum up.
Yeah, so that, you know, that was an invited op-ed, you know, coming out of the success of my 2018 forecast, previewing the model that I would put out for 2020, just to be clear. So I had not yet done the model or released the 2020 model, though that is out now and it's also on the website.
Right.
But it was just talking about, you know, this was you know, new theory of electoral behavior that I'm alone shopping out there,
right?
Out of the analyst, and you know, this is what I said. This is what I'm saying. What's gonna matter for 2020? And but yeah, no, I mean, the theory is the same factors that drove the midterm. I mean, the midterm turnout, 19 points up over 2014. And people forget, like, what Stacey Abrams did in Georgia. I mean, by far the best run campaign of the cycle. And you might say, well, wait a minute, didn't she lose? Yes, she did. Still the very best run campaign of the cycle, because in that race, in a midterm election, she got more votes than the previous year's cycles Democratic presidential nominee did in that state. I mean, that's, just truly remarkable. And I'm always kind of aghast when one of the national analysts will say, well, you know, Stacey Abrams only got, you know, whatever, 10,000 more votes than Hillary Clinton. Yeah. I'm like, do you have any idea what you're saying there? Like, that should not, it should never, shouldn't even be, she shouldn't be within 50,000 votes of Hillary Clinton, let alone exceeding Hillary Clinton.
Of course, because like, midterms, you know, never have the turnout of a presidential year, yeah.
Yeah, right. I mean, so just astronomical energy in the electorate right now, and it is, you know, this product of I mean, it's a we're going through some scary times, and anybody follow me on Twitter will know that I'm on team doom of where we are right now. But, right. You know, we also have a civic like renaissance going on, too. I mean, we'll see if the civic which is going to prevail, team doom or civic renaissance on election day, November 2020. But, you know, for many, many people, the election of Donald Trump was a wake up call.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly, and that comes back to the beginning of what we were talking about, that line that sticks with me, that the woman said to Hillary, I didn't vote, didn't think you needed me. Now they know they're needed, and this is the line I keep saying about Trump. He won last time because people didn't really think he could win. Now they know he can, and that's why I don't think he will.
Yeah, and in my forecast, I say Donald Trump has gone from a person that nobody thought who could be president to a person that people feel like treat like he's the Terminator, right? Mm-hmm. Like he cannot be killed,
right?
I mean, they're like, and I say this too in the forecast, no amount of polling data or forecast into this election in the fall of 2020 is ever going to convince people that he's going to lose too because of what happened. So, you know, the energy and the turnout rates are going to be extremely high. That said, you know, it's not tinfoil hat to assume the GOP is willing, and I think they've demonstrated this by their inaction, given the Senate Intel report that we saw come out, I mean, months ago, but again yesterday, begging Bob Mueller, you know, in front of Congress, hey, we need election security. We're not seeing those things because the GOP believes that interference will benefit them electorally. There, you know, it's not going to be a clean election. We know that. So, you know, there are just things that are going to be working against democracy too. And you know, ultimately, though, if enough people vote, and we saw this in the midterms, it's going to overwhelm any effort that could possibly be. Yeah,
it won't matter. Yeah, exactly.
It won't matter. Yeah.
No, that's for sure. And there's no bigger motivator than Trump. That's been obvious. And I keep emphasizing that. Again, I think it's what you just said, where people are, you can hand them as much data as you want, and they still are fearful and won't believe that he'll lose. But that's a motivator to get them to the polls, which is ultimately, for those who want Trump defeated, what we want. But I do say that there really isn't any data that you can point to that puts Trump in anything but a really bad position for re-election. You know, again, that's why I keep emphasizing, like I did off the top, that it was a fluke win. We have to acknowledge this.
And, yes, that's exactly right. Yeah, I mean, it's a freak accident. The things that had to come together to make that happen once. The reason nobody saw it coming, and that includes Nate Silver, you know, whose model technically had a 15% probability of a Trump electoral college win and a popular vote, you know, going to Clinton by almost 3%. So he's, you know, he's technically covered in the model, but nobody saw it coming. And the reason is because everything had to come together.
Right, exactly, which we assume won't happen in 2020. Listen, I've really enjoyed it. Next time, maybe you can come on again and we can talk some red state stuff, which I like to do on this podcast, of course, but we took a lot of time covering this and it was important. So I appreciate your insights and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay, great.
Bye.
All right. Rachel Bitticoffer, or she calls herself on Twitter, Rachel the Doc Bitticoffer, because she is a doctor of political science, I believe. On Twitter, she's her handle is at Rachel Bitticoffer. I will spell that for you. Bitticoffer. Sounds like it should be pronounced Bitecoffer, but it's Bitticoffer. At Rachel Bitticoffer. You can find her on Twitter. And she mentioned the university where a lot of that data and analysis It's spelled W-A-S-E-N, Wasson Center. You can Google that, as she suggested. And again, a reminder, she came out with her midterm predictions that the Democrats were going to have a blue wave and flip 40 seats. She came out with that in the summer of 2018, way ahead of anybody else. And as we discussed in the interview, she published that New York Times piece, which you'll want to Google, in January of this year, saying basically Trump's going to lose. So she's someone to keep an eye on. Rachel Bitticoffer, appreciate her joining us today. You can follow me on Twitter as well, as I always let you know. I'm the Civil Liberal, but my handle is at CF the Podcast. We're also on Facebook. We love it when you like the page on Facebook. Just search for CF the Podcast. I post the episodes, of course, but other things, other articles and other interesting things going on, particularly in the red states, what Democrats are doing. We didn't get a chance to go over it fully with Rachel, but you know, she did hint at Texas and Georgia and some of these red states that are ripe for the picking for Democrats, both in Senate races and probably at the presidential level with Trump on the ballot in 2020. CFThePodcast.com, of course, is the website. That's where you can hear other episodes of this podcast, CFThePodcast.com. And if you want to support the podcast, you can click support, which is on the website. And we appreciate any kindness you may be feeling towards the podcast. We have some expenses. We record at dbaudio.ca, a fantastic studio, and we have some marketing and website hosting and design costs as well. So every little bit helps, and we do appreciate it. And also, there's a mailing list on the website, and the mailing list is our best way to keep in touch with you about episodes when they're released and anything else we might be doing in the near future. You know, who knows? Maybe we'll do a live podcast one day that people can actually show up and attend, or some other event. So we love it when you sign up for the mailing list. It's free. I think it's at the bottom of the homepage. Should take you about 30 seconds to fill in. And we will be in touch. And nothing in your inbox except official correspondence from CF headquarters. That wraps up another fine edition of Clusterfuck. Thanks for listening.
The Clusterfuck Podcast, a liberal host with red state guests.
This is Roger King. That'll be all.